This is Solve It for Kids.
Hey, 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 my friends, you are looking so good. Welcome to Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, aquanauts, and other experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hello, Jen.
Jennifer, what's going on?
Oh, not much, but we have a really special Solve It for Kids podcast today. I'm so excited.
I am loving this. This is so much fun. We're meeting so many fantastic guests. I spoke to an astronaut last week. That was so much fun. I'm really, really psyched. So let's spin the wheel, get right to it, meet our guests.
Hold on. Don't we have some kids that we have to recognize for our new Solve It for Kids team?
Yeah, I almost forgot. Okay, who are the new team members?
We would like to say hello to Christopher and Nakaira. Welcome to the Solve It for Kids team.
Oh, yeah. Christopher and Nakaira, welcome. Thanks for being team members. You guys are awesome. Hey, how did Nakaira and Christopher become team members?
Well, it's really easy. All you have to do is go to our website, solveitforkids.com, and click on the Join the Team button, and you can go to our Patreon page, and it'll tell you all about how to become a team member.
I never would have thought of that. Click on the button that says Become a Team Member. Okay, is it time for me to spin the wheel?
It is time for you to spin the wheel.
What would you bring to an underwater spaceship?
What in the world is an underwater spaceship? And I don't even know what that is. I can't imagine what you would need to bring to it.
Oh, it is exciting stuff we have here, Jed. Last week we had an astronaut. This week we have the amazing Fabien Cousteau on our podcast. He is aquanaut and ocean conservationist, and he's going to tell us all about what it would be like to live under the ocean.
Please welcome to the show, famed aquanaut and ocean conservationist, Fabien Cousteau.
Hey, everyone from underwater. I wish I was wearing my wetsuit.
I know. Wouldn't that be awesome? So we are thrilled, Solve It guests, to have Fabien today on our show because he is going to answer the question, what would you take to live in an underwater space station? Now, before we go there and answer that whole question, let's have Fabien start out by telling us a little bit about what he does and what is an underwater space station.
Well, first, a lot of good questions. I'm an ocean explorer and conservationist. I happen to be an aquanaut because an aquanaut is like an astronaut in space, just underwater. Same kind of training, same kind of extreme environment, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get into that. One of the things that I love doing is spending time underwater. And that's a luxury because if you've ever gone diving or if you ever thought of going diving, you know that you have to go back to the surface eventually. And that's the real bummer of it because just as things start getting interesting underwater, you're running low on time, you're running low on air, and that's it. You have to go back to the surface dwellers. So for me, to become a fish is like the biggest dream ever. And the best way to do that is, in my opinion, to be based out of an underwater house or habitat. And there are very few in history. My grandfather built some of the first ones in the 1960s. And, of course, the United States and other countries also followed suit and built some of their own. Today, there's only one left. Actually, it's right behind me, if you can see that photo right there. That's an underwater habitat. Actually, you can see the diver right there. And it's a really amazing, fun place. Now, it's a fun place, but it's not a big space. And if you've ever lived in a city, And if you imagine, say, your big brother or big sister living with their college friends, it's like a dorm room, right?
Very small.
6 people in the something the size of a school bus.
Oh, man.
And you have to live down there for days and weeks to do your science and your experiments and your filming. So it's kind of like a really tiny house, like that series on television. And, you know, your 5 other best friends are there with you for the entirety of the time.
They better be your best friends, right?
They will be by the end. There's a lot that goes into it. Obviously, there's a lot of training involved before you can do this. There's a lot of mental preparation, because once you go down there, you can't come back up. You become a saturation diver, which means that you're trading the access to the surface world the way a scuba diver can go back up to the surface. But in exchange, you get unprecedented access, meaning all-out access to the bottom world, which is pretty awesome. And for me, that's really worth the trade-off. To be in a small space, you know, you're there to sleep, you're there to eat, but you're really there to go out into that ocean and really explore your neighborhood where all the cool critters are.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I'm still a little, I don't quite understand what it means to be a saturation diver. You explained really well the advantages when that happens, but what exactly does that mean?
It's a very good question. And so a saturation diver is, in some sense, a person does the opposite of what a scuba diver does. And by that I mean, in some sense, a scuba diver avoids decompression obligations or saturation in your body of nitrogen and other gases. When you're breathing air, there's other stuff in the air, including nitrogen, right? There's nitrogen, there's oxygen, there's trace gases. The longer you stay underwater and the deeper you are, the more those nitrogen bubbles get pushed into your tissues and into your bones and everything else. And so in order to come back up, you need those things to come out of your body in a safe way. If you go up too fast, it's like shaking a Coke bottle and opening it up, right? The Coke goes everywhere, the bubbles go crazy and everything else. And that's exactly what you're trying to avoid. Mm. And so as a scuba diver, you avoid those things by following the dive tables, by not going too deep for too long. With a saturation diver, we flip things on its head. And we maximize our decompression obligations, which means that we would have to go really, really slowly back to the surface or sit in a decompression chamber for hours and sometimes days. But because we have maximized our obligations, that actually gives us that green card to stay down for a long, long period of time. I'm simplifying because there's a lot more involved, but essentially that's what it is.
So when you're saturation diving, you have more nitrogen in your blood normally and in your tissues than you would, is what you're saying. And that's okay as long as you take precautions in how you enter back up to the surface, right?
Well, like most things, if you take the right precautions, then by and large, most situations are safe. And in terms of diving, and our world is a really interesting place, right? Compression of gases and pressures and things like that is pretty awesome.
Yes.
But in water, because water is 1,000 times denser than air, every 10 meters you go underwater is another atmosphere of pressure, right? So at the surface of the water, you have one atmosphere. At 10 meters or 33 feet, you have 2 atmospheres. At 20 meters, you have 3 atmospheres, and so on and so forth. And so very quickly, the gas bubbles that you're breathing in, right? The gas bubbles that are going into your right. system are getting compressed smaller and smaller and smaller because gas is compressible.
Yep.
And that sneaks into all sorts of nooks and crannies in your body. And it's pretty cool to look at it on a scientific level, but on a physiological level, you have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want to be safe, then you go up slowly and there are tables to follow and all that.
Right.
And that's not a problem. It's only when you go up fast that you start having the Coca-Cola problem. I hate to beat up on Coca-Cola, but whatever, soda problem.
Soda problem, got it.
Well, and that's an image that, because I don't want that happening in my body. I don't want any gas bubbles blowing up like a Coke in my body.
Well, and that's why the number one rule when you're learning to scuba dive is you don't hold your breath when you come back towards the surface.
Oh, right?
Because
okay.
The air expands in your lungs as well, and you don't want to hurt your lung tissue.
So when you're down there, okay, so first of all, tell us how long you have been down there, because I know people have been in space for, what, 14 months? But yeah. We haven't been underwater for very long. How long have you been there?
Yeah, it's funny. You and I have done a comparison of astronauts and aquanauts in the past, and so that's always a really neat debate. In some ways, the ocean environment is even more extreme than space in that you have that variable pressure, which is something that you always have to mitigate. And with regard to staying underwater in that, I'll call it a hostile environment, an alien environment for an extended period of time, it does very strange things to your body. It also does very strange things to your mind, just like in space when you're isolated. And so we haven't had the opportunity to go much more than a few days or a few weeks as a group of aquanauts. For the first time since my grandfather's days, a group of us was able to stay down for 31 days. Now, individuals, there's one individual, actually happens to be an astronaut as well, who stayed down for, I think it was 72 days or 69 days.
Oh, wow.
But that's because he refused to come back up. That's a U.S. Navy thing. I'm not getting into it. but pretty Go neat Navy. To know that he came back up safe. There are no long-term effects on your body. Psychologically, of course, you have to get adjusted again.
Well, you don't get to see the cool stuff outside and swim with the fish and all the animals. I think that would be the thing that I would miss the most.
My biggest bummer, like the most depressing day of my mission, where my group and I of Aquanauts stayed for 31 days during Mission 31, my saddest day was having to go back to the surface.
Yeah.
We had to trade that luxury of time underwater, decompress, as I was mentioning earlier, and then go back up to the surface to rejoin what really was a shock to us, because we had gotten so used to that underwater world, which was full of life and color and movement and everything else, just a really dynamic environment. And then we go up to the surface and we pierce that blue veneer back into relative emptiness. I mean, there's a sky, there were a couple of birds, and then there were a couple of human beings on a boat ready to pluck us out of the water. But compared to what was at the bottom, it was just shockingly different. And it makes me want to go back every time I have that conversation.
This is, I'm blown away, you know, because when I think about being underwater, it's like, yeah, you're like underwater in the middle of nowhere, but it sounds like you're like in Life Central down in the bottom of the ocean. There's so much going on, and that we're in the middle of nowhere up here on the surface.
Relatively speaking, you're absolutely correct. We are essentially, comparatively, in a desert wasteland. I mean, our house was parked in a National Marine Sanctuary called Penny Camp State Park.
Oh, wow.
And it was a fireworks display of life. We were literally, we plopped, or we didn't plop, but the house was plopped in the middle of an underwater city. A coral reef is a city. You have your doctors, you have your restaurants, you have your hotels, you have all these things that are functioning just like a city. It just doesn't look like our cities. But if you sit there and observe, I mean, it's like watching a soap opera unfold in front of your eyes. It's just amazing.
That is so cool. Now, when you were down there, because you and I have talked about this, tell us some of the things you experienced. Like, didn't your sense of taste kind of go away?
Oh,
some of that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, how did you feel while you were down there? Did you sleep okay? All that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, we didn't want to squander our time down there, so I'll answer that last part first. we dove 10 to 12 hours a day, each of us, to go out into that water column and maximize the opportunity. And by that, I mean that we'd go out and do scientific experiments, and we'd do filming and observation and so on and so forth. And we'd also do Skype in the classroom sessions, live from the bottom of the sea.
Oh, I mean,
really,
cool.
Really awesome. You know, it was such a unique experience. We had a hard time sleeping. But when we did sleep, we slept very, very deeply because of all that exhaustion. And some of the things that are different than on land are that your hair grows faster.
Really?
Your, you know, if you have a bruise or something like that, it heals faster. If you have an infection, however, it also goes rampant much faster, so you have to get treated much more quickly. Your sense of taste goes dull. And, you know, I've got to say, I have a lot of respect for astronauts, but now that I had done 31 days at the bottom of the sea eating astronaut food, I have even more respect for those astronauts because that stuff was awful. Freeze-dried food morning, noon, and evening. And it was a good thing that our sense of taste went dull because we had to eat 3 times as many calories as we do on land because of all the energy that we're burning.
Oh, wow.
To try and stay warm, to go out diving. We'd burn anywhere, depending on the person, 3 to 5 times as many calories.
Oh,
and so we'd be chugging down peanut M&Ms. We'd be doing, you know, all those packets of food. You can't keep fresh foods in a habitat at those pressures because fresh foods go bad very quickly.
Oh,
they oxidize.
Yeah.
3 times as much pressure, 3 times as much oxygen, 3 times as much oxygen. The oxidation goes much faster. So a head of lettuce would go bad in a day or two. Apple would go bad. As soon as you bit it, it would go bad in just an hour. I mean, it's crazy.
Wow. So Jed wants to go down because you said it grows your hair. Right?
Yeah. I love that.
He was like, yeah, I'm good for that. I don't know if it makes it grow back, Jed.
Well, that would be a fantastic experiment, wouldn't it?
I'm willing to sacrifice to see if it works.
Hey, we told the astronauts that we would love to go to space. I don't know. I'm thinking aquanauts. I think I would go down in Aquarius. Yeah, that would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
You hit the nail right on the head. The anecdote is really cool between aquanauts and astronauts. There are a lot of similarities. As a matter of fact, NASA astronauts train underwater before they go into space. So they have to become scuba divers before they become astronauts. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like the more I learn about aquanauts, and I just learned about aquanauts a while ago when I met Jennifer for the first time, but it seems like there's so much to discover under the water. I think somebody explained to us that we've only explored about 5% of the ocean. That seems crazy to me.
Yes.
Isn't that mind-blowing?
Yes.
I mean, we've explored, take all of modern-day ocean exploration, last 100 years, including scuba diving and submersibles and ROVs and, you know, AUVs and all that stuff. We've explored less than 5% of our ocean world to date. If you take into account our world as a living space, the ocean, all 3.4 billion cubic kilometers of volume, represents over 99% of our world's living space, within which the vast majority of the biodiversity lives and thrives. So it's a wonderland of opportunity for exploration and discovery. And we're just now getting into the modern day ocean exploration. It's still very much in its nascent stage because, funding is always a problem. Technology is just now catching up. A lot of times we adapt technology that's built for land or for space exploration to explore underwater. I believe that if we develop technology to explore underwater, we'll be much better equipped to go explore other places, including space and other planets.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, especially because, as you know, since Fabian was one of the experts on my Astronaut Aquanaut book, we talked about this, but they are so similar, but yet different. But you still have to deal with the idea of pressure, and that's probably one of the biggest things that that you have to deal with as an aquanaut that's very different from being an astronaut. But if you could work out how to do that initially, maybe that would help us with planet exploration, because we're going to encounter different pressures and different atmospheres on different planets.
The environments will be very different depending on where we go. But I will venture to say that I'm hard-pressed to believe that in the short term we'll find a more beautiful planet than this one that we have the privilege of living on. And the bounty of flora and fauna and diversity and just the matrix that supports the life that we all take advantage of every day is just simply amazing. I mean, for example, I don't know if you know this, but every other breath that we've taken during this podcast and every other breath that everyone on this planet takes is thanks to the ocean. Mm. The ocean generates that oxygen, half that oxygen that we breathe. And so we don't think about it, but we're really blessed to have a little oasis in space. And okay, we haven't even explored it yet, which is pretty cool opportunity for a lot of people.
Exactly.
I have a question, and I know that the smart people out there understand this, but I don't understand this. So we have this big space, and we've only explored 5% of it. And I know your grandfather was one of the first people to start really exploring it, and he took me down there when I was a kid. Was spending all this money, people talking about, oh, one day we're going to live on Mars, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. That doesn't seem to make sense that we're, you know, I love that we're thinking about exploring space and maybe living on other planets, but shouldn't we also be spending just as much time thinking about maybe we could live under the water and, like, take advantage of what's, like, right outside our door?
You're absolutely right. And my grandfather had spent over 50 years with his crew on Calypso, and my grandmother showing the world through 134 documentaries, what this oasis in space was like, what the ocean world was like. And I'm all for space exploration. As a matter of fact, you know, the next ocean that they find on Mars or Europa or what have you, you know, sign me up. I'd love to go and explore. But by and large, we really stand to use this opportunity of ocean exploration and temporary colonization of underwater to better ourselves, to better prepare ourselves for that space exploration. Because at the end of the day, if you're going to send a handful of people to Mars to colonize Mars, as a matter of fact, right now, I don't think we're ready yet. We have a lot of challenges to do that. Yeah. Some of those challenges could be addressed by going through the process of this just underwater, because it's also an extreme environment. It may not be the same as right. Mars, but it's just as isolated once you're saturated. And we're able to go through a lot of the mechanics, a lot of the interactions, a lot of the emergency situations, and a lot of the opportunities in an environment that's a lot closer to home, and one that will give us a lot of intellectual fortunes, as well as be able to get a better understanding for what makes this place tick and how we can best preserve it. Because even if we do colonize Mars or Europa, it's not going to be all 7.8 billion people and growing that are going to be moving to that place. Most of us will still be here.
So, wishing we were there, right? Or wishing we were
I don't think
there.
So. I talked to a lot of astronauts, and they love what they do. I totally get it. But, you know, they're always looking back at this little blue orb floating in the vast inky dark. And there's always this, like, feeling of home when you see planet Earth, which actually should be called planet Ocean.
We'll change that. We'll just go ahead and change it for you.
But it's funny that colonizing other places would be great, but at the end of the day, there's no such place as home.
Yes. Very good. Also, I want to tell our young listeners, so we keep referring to Fabian's grandfather, that is Jacques Cousteau. Go look him up, okay? So he was an amazing man, and so for those of us that grew up watching his undersea adventures, we were all, I know, I was glued to the TV back then, and, you know, that was when my love for the ocean began. So definitely go Google him or do an internet search and find out about Fabian's entire Cousteau family. But we also want to get back to the problem. Okay, so when you were talking about the underwater spaceship, so what we're talking about is, you know, Aquarius, kind of an underwater space lab where they would live. So what do you get to take with you? Like, if you get to take, I don't know, is it only one backpack? Is that all you get?
That's such an awesome question, and one that you started this conversation with that I neglected to answer. It's really difficult because you know you're going to be down there for a long period of time, and you want to bring everything. It's just like going on a trip, right? Except now you also have to bring all your work stuff. And personal items, because you're talking about something really small, size of a school bus, with six people in it who are going to be living there and based out of there day in and day out, there'll be a small section where you can sleep. There are bunks, just like a submarine. There's a middle section where we call it the common area or the galley, where you can cook with hot water, reconstitute your food, sit down and have a break. You know, it's a tiny little table for four people. I know I said six, only four can sit at a time. The other two have to go work or sleep or whatever. And then the third section is really the laboratory and the wet porch, which is the place where you come in and out of the habitat. It's a very, very small with you that you can store with you. A couple of your favorite t-shirts, a couple of good books, your toothbrush, of course. You cannot bring things like smelly deodorants or shampoos or things like that, because this is another aspect of that multiple atmosphere that messes with your daily routine, right? Because those things that we use on land have fragrances and other chemicals, those things can potentially become toxic underwater at three atmospheres, and you don't want to keep breathing that stuff in. Because you're in a bubble, essentially, and you're rebreathing that air over and over and over, right, that's recirculated. So you have to be very careful with those sorts of things. No perfumes and things like that.
So it sounds like it could get kind of ripe down there.
And that, you know, that was one of my biggest fears of pushing the limits. Before Mission 31, the longest anyone had been down in that nice little cozy space was 17 days, and that was a group of NASA astronauts during the NEMO missions. And my worry was, well, we can't put deodorant on. They do supply us with soap and shampoo that doesn't have any chemicals in it, any artificial chemicals. And so what's going to happen when six of us are in there for extended periods of time? You know, it gets kind of gamey on the surface. But funny enough, first of all, we had a freshwater shower as a rinse when we get out of the ocean. But more importantly, when you're in the ocean, the salt water itself is a deodorizer. And it's a cleaner. So it does clean you very, very well. So we didn't have any problems in the dry part of the habitat. And I'll explain that if you really want me to. But in the dry part of the habitat, we didn't have any bodily odor problems, with the occasional exception of violating certain rules. There is a cardinal rule, and I won't mention it on this podcast, but there is a cardinal rule for all aquanauts not to do within the context of other people around.
Well, and then without going into a bunch of details, I know kids have asked me this a billion times, where do you go to the bathroom when you're down there? Yeah. So we'll let you answer that one.
It's a very common question, especially amongst young people. I love that question because what goes in must come out, even down below, especially when you're eating 3 to 5 times as much food.
Exactly.
That's right.
There, in training, the trainers specifically tell you that you will need to poop within 24 to 36 hours of your arrival at the bottom to make sure that you're functioning, you're physically functioning properly. And if not, they will give you a laxative. And, you know, some people get very nervous and that affects things. Some people just are too shy and that affects things. But you have to remember you're in a tiny little space and there's only really officially one option, which is a marine toilet, a marine head, as they call it, right next to the laboratory and right before the wet porch. And it's basically like a mini throne with a shower curtain.
Oh,
and that's your only privacy with the rest of the world.
So it would be like, excuse me, can you all go out of the habitat for a minute so I could have my privacy?
Many people have anxiety about this. And you're also sharing sounds and smells and everything else. And that's not very pleasant for the rest of us. So there's an unofficial way as well, which is to go take an ocean walk to a place called the gazebo. And I know that's not very PC, but believe me, that's a much better option than the one inside. The one inside is for emergency uses mainly. we've had a few of those, but for the most part, it's unused, and they prefer going outside.
But outside is, I mean, it's like when you go camping and you're not near a latrine. I mean, this is what people do.
In essence, it's exactly the same thing, except, and there is an exception. I'm trying to explain this in a way that won't be too gross. The fish have gotten very used to people going outside. And as opposed to the woods, where all you have to really contend with are the occasional fly or mosquito, fish, including chubs, can become very large animals and very aggressive. And there have been injuries in places no one wants an injury. So you have to be very careful.
Well,
all of our kids are laughing. All the parents are cringing at the moment.
Well,
but all the kids are like, thank you. You asked my question, right, Jed? This is the question.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm getting all sorts of visuals here. And I'm imagining you need to have a mirror out so you can see what's going on behind you as you're going on behind you.
Over the years, the aquanauts that have used Aquarius as a habitat have gotten very creative with this particular endeavor. And when they would go out to the what we call the gazebo, which is basically like a canopy with a bubble so that you can stick your head out and you don't have to be on scuba all the time. They devised a bubble curtain around the gazebo to try and keep fish away. And for a while that worked. Unfortunately, some of these resident fish are very smart and swim right through the bubble curtain and then get trapped inside the bubble curtain. So that they're doing what we call the gazebo shuffle to keep them away.
So, okay, there right there is your problem. And then you figured out how to solve it, and it's still a problem. So there you have it.
It just shows there's no beating nature. Nature knows best.
Well, and I think you just answered the question, what's the weirdest thing you do underneath the water? I'm wondering, what's the weirdest or the scariest creature you've encountered?
Oh, that's a good one, yeah.
Wow. Well, that going to the bathroom is definitely one of the weirder things compared to land that you have to do. One of the scariest things, I would say, human beings underwater are probably the scariest thing to me because we have a bad reputation. We have a really bad reputation. Some are very good and some not so much. So, you know, without going too deep into it, I think we are our own worst enemy. And I think we are also the solution. So that would be my answer as far as the scariest. The second scariest, you know, are usually the small critters, the ones that either we don't know anything about, that could be very poisonous, such as the most venomous animal on the planet, which is the cone snail. A lot of people pick them up because they love the beautiful shell that they have.
Right.
But those animals should definitely be left alone. They are quite dangerous, especially if you are picking it up the wrong way and you get a dart in your finger. And then you have other critters, you know, the usual kind, the visiting sharks and things that, to me, are not scary at all. They're much more predictable than many other animals. As a matter of fact, they're beautiful and graceful when they come by. And as long as you're acting and behaving in a non-aggressive way and you have them in your visual sight, it's almost always not a problem. And if it does become a problem, you just go back on your boat or go back to the habitat, and that's not an issue. I didn't see too many really scary things. We were filming things like manta shrimp, which are awesome. Some of my favorite critters down there. Octopus, really, really hard to find. They're very elusive, especially in that part of the world. And believe it or not, something that I never focused on before until Brian and Mark and the team from Northeastern pointed them out, is sponges. You know, I've seen them on the reefs, but I never really put my attention to them. When we started doing some of the research for sponges down there and collecting specimens, it was amazing to see how many species were down there and how differently they function on the reef.
Wow.
From the barrel sponges to all those little corkscrew sponges, etc. When there was a cold water upwelling from the deep going over the reef wall onto the reef where we were, we found that cold water would shut down the metabolism of the entire reef. Everything would go dormant. All the fish would go hiding. And it was almost like an abandoned city. And as that cold water would wash away and the warm water would come back, all that sea life would come popping out again, and then it would be this crazy cacophony all around, just like a New York City. And one of the exceptions was the barrel sponge, because it was this big, giant cauldron. And so inside was still this cold water, and we were able to measure all sorts of really cool things. Dissolved oxygen, CO2, hydrocarbons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but also the temperature variations and the way the sponge was still shut down until that cold water went through its pores in exchange for warm water, and then it would start siphoning things off again.
Wow.
It was really neat. Really neat.
So what I'm hearing is while you go down there because it's amazing, you're also going down there to study for science, to learn things about what you're seeing. And, you know, because I would go down there and be like, wow, this is so cool. While you do that, of course, but you're also down there making hypotheses. Like, we think this is what happens when, you know, like you just said, but then you learn something else maybe.
And that's absolutely why we're doing it. As much as it's amazing and as much as I just love sitting there and just watching everything unfold in front of my eyes, and it's very easy to do because you go into this trance-like state like, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is just weird and awesome and amazing. I mean, you know, the more you would go down there, the more the animals of the reef, of that underwater city, would start accepting you as just a natural part of the life cycle, because they realize you're not aggressive, you're not going to eat them, you're not this foreign thing that comes down for 45 minutes and chases them around. You're there, and everything starts becoming normal. The Goliath grouper would come up, you know, fairly close to us. These are grouper. They're the largest grouper in the grouper family in the world. They get to be over 8 feet long and 800 pounds if you let them grow that big. And they are just amazing, giant, phenomenal puppy dogs.
800-pound puppy dog. Okay. I'll believe you.
They're so cool. I mean, they open their mouth wide enough to just swallow, you know, your head and your shoulders, but they're just gentle giants for, as far as we're concerned. If you're a small fish, that's not true. But what's really cool is when you can observe them down there, if you have, you know, enough time to boom, which is when they bark and open their mouth, they boom, and that boom is like this pressure wave that comes out from that, from their snapping their jaw really quickly, that that creates this pressure wave that if you're close enough, it actually hurts your chest. It feels like you got punched in the chest.
Oh my gosh.
That pressure wave is strong enough to stun their prey. And within a split second, they do that boom and they slurp up the prey and it's gone. I mean, it's down their gullet. If you do a slow motion video of this, which we had the opportunity to with this really cool piece of tech that we're testing out from MIT called the Edgertronic that shoots 20,000 frames a second, right?
In
this
Holy box, cow.
Wow.
You're able to see a cavitation bubble form right in front of their mouths that's hotter than the surface of the sun for just one split second.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
We'll have to see if you, is that video online somewhere that we could add that to our website?
We have some of the mantis shrimp, which is another cool animal that's really hard to film unless you have something like the Edgertronic, because mantis shrimp, just like its namesake, has these praying mantis arms that snap out and catch their prey just like a praying mantis on land. But you can't see that with the naked eye. So we had to shoot, I think it was 6,000 or 8,000 frames a second just to be able to see the biomechanics of it.
You know, you're talking about that grouper creating this bubble that's like hotter than the sun for a second. I'm imagining that like figuring out how that happens could really help us here on land with energy and stuff.
So that's a great, great point. And one of the main reasons why we were down there was, of course, to share what we were doing with the world live, because we had live cameras all over the place. But more importantly is the research. Right. And we did a number of different kinds of research and leveraged as much time as we had down there on it. And biomechanics, as well as biochemistry, as well as, of course, marine biology and such, are some of the main focuses that we had. And sometimes you just stumble on behavior like what you're describing, what I described earlier with the Goliath grouper, which is fascinating and triggers ideas in your head for things just like energy. You're absolutely correct. Or how about using that cold water upwelling, you know, the differential in temperature from cold water to warm water to create energy?
Yep.
There are technologies out there now that we could adopt for renewable energies, things like OTEC, ocean thermal energy conversion, that could power the world nine times over without any significant environmental impact to our ocean.
Wow.
And we just need to be able to develop that on a scale that allows us to give that energy to the world. And we would be much better off as human beings if we did. And there's so many more discoveries down there. Imagine that right now the pharmaceutical industry, the biochemical industry, has only discovered about a dozen or so treatments that we use in hospitals and in pharmacies and all that, that are based on underwater resources. You know that cone snail I was telling you about earlier, mm-hmm. with the most venomous dart on the world, on the
yes.
planet? Scientists have synthesized this, have replicated it, and are now, there's a treatment for chronically ill patients and for pain mitigation for a treatment that is 1,000 times more powerful, more effective than morphine,
wow.
but without any of the side effects from that.
Oh, that's the best part, without any of the side effects. See, all of our listeners, this is what you want to be, aquanauts, when you grow up, right?
Well,
study everything.
Oh man, from the bacteria down there to the corals, to the sponges, to the cone snails, and the Goliath grouper, and the sharks, there's so much that we just haven't yet even thought about that we could really, really discover. You could be the next, Curie, or the next, you might find the next cure to COVID-19.
Well, that's what I'm, the thing I'm hearing from you is that there's so much to do. I mean, our listeners who are 8, 9, and 10 years old right now can spend their entire lives and never discover all there is to learn from the ocean.
Exactly.
There's so much there. It will take many generations for us to be able to learn from and extract the research and the technology and the information that we could really stand to benefit from. So there's a lot left for everyone out there to be able to discover. And whether it's from the microscopic to the macroscopic, there's so much there for everyone. And it's a wonderland. It's something to me that I grew up with that conjures up something that we use all the time at the Ocean Learning Center, which is a saying that my grandfather said to me when I was a kid. People protect what they love. They love what they understand, and they understand what they're taught. If we don't know anything about the ocean, how can we teach others about how beautiful, how valuable, how precious it is?
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about your Ocean Learning Center and what you do with
it? Oh, sure. Yeah. So one of the things I've always cherished is being able to share stories, share information, share ideas with others. And to be able to do that in a foreign environment, in an ocean, in the underwater world, if you will, is not always easy because many people will never get a chance to see it.
Yep.
Many people will never get a chance to see it firsthand anyway and won't get a chance to experience it, more importantly, you know, to really go down there and go scuba diving or go snorkeling and really see and feel what it's like to be in the ocean. And so it's very important to be able to share those stories so that those out there who won't get that chance will at least get an understanding of we exist because the ocean exists. We are blessed to be able to have this amazing little blue orb as our home. And to be able to connect with it on an intellectual and an emotional level is absolutely paramount for us to be able to make better decisions in our everyday lives. Because as we, you know, look at news and everything else, and it's a lot of bad news out there, talking about plastic pollution and all sorts of other sad stuff, we need to take that and create solutions. The only way we can create solutions is to better understand what's going on out there. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a way that was absolutely important, of paramount importance as a storyteller. And so the Ocean Learning Center was created a few years ago because I was very frustrated with not being able to invite people and communities, whether it's on a virtual platform, such as what we're doing now, or in person, in the field, to be able to create those solutions, gather together, share ideas, share knowledge, and create a better world. And so we've got programs in different parts of the world that span from sea turtle restoration coupled with women empowerment in Nicaragua to 3D coral printing to do coral restoration. Oh, it's so cool.
That's amazing. Well, and kids can do stuff too, right? You have stuff
absolutely.
For kids to do. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, it's for the young and the young at heart. We really love to have kids participate in, you know, all these things like eelgrass and seagrass restoration and things like that, as well as, you know, creating 3D structures that we can then use to bring down to the coral reef for coral restoration, to just generally doing beach cleanups and mangrove plantings and things that they can physically be part of, but also they become the ambassadors, right? They become the teachers because now not only that do they do something really cool and really good and hopefully had fun with it, but now they're telling their parents and their friends and their schools and their community, and they've become the ones that are the sentinels. They become the guardians. They become the teachers. And to me, that's the whole point.
Exactly.
That's so cool. So cool. I love that you're talking about kids becoming the sentinels and the ambassadors for the ocean. We love to have our kids be part of the show. We love the show to be totally interactive. Do you have something that you can challenge our listeners with today?
Sure, absolutely. So here, I just found a piece of plastic. I see this is a single-use plastic. I'm sorry you can't see it very well, but it's a packaging. There's something in it right now. As human beings, especially in North America, use over 8 single-use pieces of plastic every single day in our daily lives, we as individuals. So imagine if each one of us were to cut that down to, say, 6 or 5 or 4 or none, how quickly we would have a huge impact, cumulatively speaking, to our ocean. Our ocean carries right now over 100 million tons of plastic in it every year.
Wow.
So we really need to pay attention. We're going to places as explorers where no human being's ever been, and we see signs of human impact. We see plastic everywhere and so on. So if we want to start eliminating those garbage mounds in the ocean, we need to start right from the source, right from where it starts, which is in our everyday decisions. And that's something easy to do. First of all, it saves money, at least to your parents. Secondly, it makes a real impact. And that's nothing difficult, right? It doesn't cost anything. It doesn't really challenge you to do anything but change your thought process in that one action. A second one that we could do is to be more careful. And I don't know, 10-year-olds, 8, 10, 12-year-olds may not like eating seafood very much. Who knows? Maybe they do. But we are faced with a real challenge in our oceans. There are very, very few animals left in our ocean world as far as wild stocks. Mm-hmm. And if we used a seafood watch guide, for example, that's something else that could help. The Monterey Bay Aquarium, for example, has a great one. There are others out there as well. And if we go to a restaurant or to a supermarket, we can have our parents make a better decision, not only for the ocean, but also sometimes for our own health. Because as I was mentioning plastic earlier, half the seafood in the supermarket today has microplastics in it.
Oh, wow.
So we really need to be careful that for the ocean and for ourselves. And so not eating things that are rare or endangered, as well as not eating things that already have contaminants in it, usually a pretty good thing for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, exactly. So, Fabian, we know that you're working on some really amazing projects for Aquanauts, of course, and ocean conservation. Do you have a challenge that maybe the kids can do and, like, take a picture of or something and share with us?
You know, I think that's a great, great idea. I'm always looking forward in ocean exploration, and so I think my challenge to your viewers would be, what about drawing the next underwater habitat? The International Space Station underwater. What would that look like? Draw it up, post it online, take a picture of it, share it with your social media, tag us, tag you guys, and really show the world that we have a lot left to discover in our ocean, and you're going to be the next Aquanaut.
Oh, I love that idea. So everyone make sure that you tag us on Twitter and Instagram. We are Kids Solved. And we will make sure to tag Fabian, and so he can take a look at it, and if he has time, he can comment on it. Maybe someone will make you a really cool, you know, think about it. Right now, you have these bunk rooms. Maybe you'll get your own bedroom, right, with your own window and all this kind of stuff, right?
I'm thinking before that, he wants a better bubble curtain for when he has to go outside and
do that kind of stuff.
There,
Jen. I
don't know.
There's still a lot of problems to solve. I can't wait to see if anyone out there has some solutions.
That's awesome. Well, it has been so wonderful having you on our show today, Fabian. I could talk to you for hours about ocean exploration because, you know, I am. Would always love to be an aquanaut, but thank you very much for taking the time to be on Solve It today.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you all of the audience, and I look forward to seeing you all down below.
Jennifer, that was amazing. Fabian was so amazing. It made me feel like I was right down there in the underwater spaceship. In fact, I think my hair's a little bit wet. It was so realistic.
It was realistic, wasn't it? And being down in Aquarius or any of these other submersibles that you can go down, I think just imagine what you could see while you were down there and all the creatures.
Wow. I know, being out there and the idea of like fish looking at you like you're in an aquarium instead of like the other way around. That's so cool.
That's very cool. Now, kids, if you listen, don't forget to go to our website to find all of these cool links on our pages. So go to solidforkids.com. Each of our podcasts has their own website page where you can learn all about the experts that we've had on our show, particularly, of course, Fabian Cousteau this week. And that's where Fabian's challenge will be too. So don't forget to do the challenge and then ask your parents if you can tag us on our Instagram or Twitter. We're at KidsSolve, or send us an email with your picture in it because we would love to see what you come up with for this challenge.
I can't wait. This is going to be awesome. Hey, Jennifer, as always, it is so much fun being on Solve It for Kids with you. Thanks so much for inviting me to go on this journey.
And it's been a blast doing this show with you too, Jen. So everyone, enjoy Solve It for Kids.